Hello, I'm ready when you are.
Okay, you're good.
I'm waiting for this to start. It's broadcasting, it's live now. Okay, welcome to another episode of Open Up and Bleed. This is K-Chung Radio, and it's very hot. Just moved out of my apartment into my old apartment, which I lived for 6 years. Just dedicated all my old tapes to K-Chung Radio. This is a humble brag. I'm beginning the show with a humble brag, delineating what sort of generous, giving individual I am in this world. And other people aren't as generous, let me say, because I was supposed to have a wonderful guest here tonight who unfortunately is stuck in another continent and is unable to make it. So I'm going to have the air all to myself right now. And actually, maybe it's a blessing in disguise. Maybe I'm just good at looking at that Silver Linings playbook. But I'm going to use this opportunity to talk about all the horrific and anxious and terrifying things and positive things and euphoric things and whatever else I'm experiencing as I'm about to release this film that I made about a year ago, a year and a half ago, and that is coming out this Friday. Let me get this thing out of my face. Okay, cool. All right. Okay, so let's start doing that. I'm going to do one thing. Can I turn this fan off? Let's turn the fan off. Turn the fan off. Great. Have a really great station manager. Sorry, what is your name?
Joseph.
God bless you, Joseph. Thanks for doing this. We've only met like a handful of times.
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to establish that I'm not some sort of person who is, what do you call that? Inauthentic. That's important. It's really important to be authentic. Don't you think, Joseph?
Yeah.
But what does authenticity mean in today's day and age where we're constantly projecting our identities out through virtual platforms, whether we view it as a sort of performance or whether we view it as an extension of how we define ourselves? It is all very confusing and, in fact, creates much difficulty, I think, in the day-to-day existence, whether it be conscious or subconscious. There is difficulty, I assure you of that. Well, in June to July of last year, actually, it's just the sliver at the end of June, at the beginning of July, a bunch of friends, and we were all friends then, and I think to a more or less extent we are all friends now, although there are complications as friendships go, got together and we made a film called A Wonderful Cloud, which was an arbitrary title chosen by myself and my girlfriend Joan Lee, who also worked on the film. And we worked on it basically from the end of June. Well, it took us, we basically had 10 days, and we shot for 8.5 days, and we had 10 days to do it. And it was starring my friend, Caitlin Scheel, who also happens to be my ex-girlfriend. And the movie was a sort of improvised romantic comedy about exes, right? And so I'm in it too, and we play each other's exes. And we made it basically for no money. We made it for a very small sum of money that another friend of mine named Christian Rosa, who's a painter, was able to give me because he was enthusiastic about my work and because he's a guy that I met 3 years earlier. Him and his girlfriend at the time, who was my friend from college, Bree Zucker, were visiting LA. Bree stayed with me. And Christian stayed with his friend, who's also is a very famous and cool artist named Raymond Pettibon. And so I didn't really meet Christian until 3 or 4 days into their stay. We all went out to hang out, and we ended up at an intense mysterious party in like Larchmont, which does not sound that mysterious, but Larchmont's kind of like upscale bougie neighborhood with nice kind of 30s 40s style houses, the kind you might see in LA Confidential or something of that period, a period piece. You know, you might also see it in something like Lady of the Lake or you know, I don't know what other LA noir there are, like Out of the Past, or there's a lot. Okay. And so yeah, I met Christian and we had a wild night that featured a bouncer pulling out a gun on us and stealing a bunch of champagne bottles from an open garage door and you know, whatever, dancing on tables, etc. And we made a bond. We bonded. That you made a bond. We bonded. Covalent bond. And then a few years later, maybe that was even 6 years ago, not three, 6 years ago. And then maybe like 2 or 3 years ago, Christian moved 3 years ago to LA. And, you know, we found intermittent opportunities to hang out. But he was very insistent on, and he very quickly became an artist of note, like a prominent artist in the worlds of collecting and the gallery world. He's a very dynamic personality. He makes very attractive paintings. And people seized upon both of those elements, and he achieved a meteoric amount of success. Now, let me close this door. Now it's really a sweat box. Yeah. Okay, good. That's how I like it. Confessional sweat box. Like the scene at 8 and a half where he's sitting in the spa, the underground catacomb spa with the Pope, the Papal Father, the Cardinal, or whatever. So Christian was insistent that with his good fortune to provide an opportunity for other artists to make art, to make the art they wanted to make. That includes painters, sculptors. He set up several residencies. He still has one going at Grande Vista. And another thing he set up was a check that he gave to me to make a movie. And for a while, I resisted him because the things I was writing were maybe a little bit bigger scale than I knew he could invest in. But then this other path crossed my way. And that path was Kate, who visited town, and she visited on a day that I got an email from like a Secretly Canadian, one of those album labels on Secretly Canadian, and they said, oh hey, can you pitch us a music video idea for this kind of like European techno song? And then Kate flew in for one day, and I was like, shit, I should just make this video on my cell phone, because I was in this phase where if the budget was very small, I wanted to only make videos on my cell phone. So I picked up Kate, and I said to her, hey, do you have like a few hours? We could make a music video. And she's like, what? And I said, okay, let's do it. So I picked her up. Basically what it was, she picked me up at the airport, and then we hung out. We went to this place called the Melody Lounge by the airport, a very nice bar I recommend. They have a lobster. They have, you know, like those claw games. We're going to get like a toy if you like claw it properly, but it's really hard, you know, put in a dollar. This is like that, but they had live lobsters on the bottom. So you would reach in, and if you grabbed a lobster, you give it to the chef, and they'd cook it for you. And that was called Lobster Zone, and that was part of the video, and then we danced in the lounge, and then we went back to, like, her place, and we got drunk and danced a little bit more, and the music's playing the whole time, of course. And then And the relationship between us is like we're exes, or like, you know, we're old friends who have an amorous vibe. And then, for no apparent reason, my perfectly nice character drugs her and basically does crude things. Not like sexual. There was nothing explicitly sexual about it, but it was very discomforting. The whole point of the video, and I felt like the vibe for the song for me, was that there was like this discomforting, anxious, evil thing underneath a kind of like sugary, friendly veneer. And then the video ends with like my girlfriend time, who was played by my girlfriend Joan, showing up, and then we kind of like made out on top of Kate's like limp body. and then we kind of exited out of there and got into a sort of fight of our own, sort of domestic squabble of our own. And that was cut, end of video. It was all shot kind of like first-person POV on the phone. It was very, like, naturally integrated into the video. And then I sent it to the label, and I said, hey, I don't even want to pitch you. I just made the video. Like, look, isn't this incredible? And then they were like, what the fuck is this? And I was like, this is good. This is, like, really innovative. This will get people talking. Like people should talk about, like, rape. And, like, the fact that most rape is done by someone that you know. And the fact that, like, there are disgusting people out there, usually men, who revel in this. And, like, people have been caught filming it. And it's, like, in the air and should be confronted. And it and the music can be, like, an avenue to explore that and get people talking, you know? And they just were not feeling that. I understand why an artist wouldn't want to be associated with that sort of vision. But to me, it was, like, necessary and provocative. And I'm not upset I did it as a thing. Even though it was completely off the table. I obviously did not get paid because they were ready to give me the job if I had done them a normal pitch. But by giving them that video that was so insane and completely, you know, kind of out of the blue, I didn't get it. But I'm happy I did it, not only because I think it's good, even though no one will ever see it, but also because it was, like, really the first time that I worked with Kate. And we had gone out briefly, long distance, for about 5 years earlier or something like that. Yeah. And it was very intense and very brief, and then it was kind of over before it could become anything, like, really tangible, you know, before we could, like, take each other to, like, parties and weddings and, like, you know, really talk about, really realistically talk about living together, even though we did talk about living together, like, a lot over the phone and email and stuff like that. So right when Kate broke up with me, we'll backtrack, right when Kate broke up with me, I also had, like, I had a movie that was due, if you can believe that, kind of like a homework assignment. I had promised some distant friends of mine that I would provide them with what I wanted to be a feature-length movie, all done kind of like this through webcam, and that was due in September. And Kate sort of broke up with me, I would say, around July or something like that, maybe August. And I wanted to do a webcam movie. I had to conceive this idea even before all the Kate stuff. I promised them, like, in February, like, I'm going to do this for you guys. And they said, great, it's due in September. I was like, great. Obviously, like, my idea was, like, oh, to do a casual movie about terrorism, domestic terrorism, like, show, like, very privileged, you know, entitled, seeming comfortable white people. Like, definitely I'm a symbolic example, if not exactly living a comfortable white person life. And just show them talking about, like, Netflix and, like, Whole Foods, and then talk about, like, robbing a bank or blowing up the IRS building or, like, you know, putting, like, fucking chemicals in the water supply, you know. And I wanted to do something like that. So August rolled around, and I was like, shit, this is due. And it was going to be kind of broadcast, released over the course of 2 weeks. So I was like, okay, it's going to be 14 episodes. And then September whatever came around, September 10th, and I was like, oh shit, like, I haven't even really begun, and the first episode's tomorrow. And then for the next 2 weeks, I live, basically, like, I recorded webcam conversations with my friends and my family and other people who had no, and just randoms, like on chat roulette or whatever, who had no idea that I was recording them and no idea that I was playing a character who was basically this sort of, like, slowly churning domestic terrorist. And early on, I realized, why would I turn from being my normal self to this, like, weird terrorist cell that I had kind of made up, that was a synthesis of an extreme sort of, like, right-wing Tea Party Waco, Texas vibes mixed with, like, radical Islam or some offshoot of radical Islam. And why would I do that? Because I was heartbroken, right? Because, you know, the classic thing, random, happy guy living a charmed life is broken up with and goes through a heartache. And how better to satirize that than to show that person becoming a preposterous domestic terrorist. Anyway, so I made that film. And in the midst of that, as luck would have it, I talked about Kate in one of the first or the second episode and what all went down, and I showed that as the inciting incident. As luck would have it, Kate contacted me somewhere around the third or fourth episode for the first time in months, and I hadn't been able to reach her. She had basically like cut me off from contact, and I think it was for the best. And she says, "Can we talk?" And I said, "I would be so happy to talk with you. But please, can we save this for a webcam chat?" And she's like, "Okay, should we just meet up on Skype right now?" And I said, "No. Like, can we meet up in 6 days?" Because at that point, I was on episode 4. And I had decided it would be, like, 10 episodes. I was like, "Can we meet up in 6 days, exactly at, like, 3 p.m.? And she said, "Okay." She didn't know what was going on. And then we met up on air, and I recorded everything, and I asked her to record it too, because I was like, okay. And this was our first conversation since this very sort of like drastic, like stone cold out of nowhere breakup that she had initiated. And it was emotional, and we were really talking about like what the fuck went down, and how we were feeling, and why she did what she did, and how it made me feel. And it was all really real, except at the same time, I was operating under this guise of a guy who's about to hijack a plane and crash it into the IRS building in Washington, D.C. And so I was also informing her about that element of it, and we were discussing all that, along with our, you know, real intimate feelings. So I had this chance to work with Kate, and I had sort of grounded this idea that we could combine, because she's a performer and I'm a director, and in a way I guess a performer too, and she understands cinema probably as good as any director. Like, we found this way to synthesize actual emotional states of being and psychological things we were going through between each other with a completely fictional scenario. And really, it was quite authentic, and I'm really proud of that. That's called Skydiver, and that's episode 10 of Skydiver. So we did the. So that was one time I worked with Kate. Then we did this disturbing music video that obviously no one will ever see. And then after the music video, I was like, "It was so fun working with you because you're really down for whatever. You trust me, and you're such a good performer. It's really believable. You know, like how we did that. It was just really." It really got to me how good she was, you know? And you know, with your friends and people that you really love, you sometimes you're afraid to work with them because you don't think they'll bring it. Like, you're afraid to ask people to help you because you're a control freak or you're insecure and you're afraid you're not going to be able to get their best out of them. Or, you know, like when your friend shows you their, like, you don't, sometimes you meet someone, you really love them, and then they tell you they're creative, like they're a musician or they're a writer. Like, if you really, like, and love them, their personality so much, you might be scared to see their work because what if you don't like it? You know, I think that's something that happens a lot more in your early 20s or teens or so. Now I'm like down for whatever, and if I don't like something, I'll break it to the person and it won't be a big deal. When I was younger, I was very harsh on people, and if I didn't like their stuff, it was like kind of like couldn't really respect. Anyway, so I maybe avoided working with Kate for a while, but then when we did that video, it was really special. And I said to her, "Well, like, you know, we should really make something together one day. We really should." And we talked about a few things, and I mentioned, well, maybe, like, we talked about the astronaut, female astronaut from a few years earlier who was having, you know, was in a relationship with a male astronaut, and then she found out he was having an affair with a different female astronaut, and she trailed that female astronaut to the museum in Houston, saw that this female astronaut was getting on a flight from Houston to like Cape Canaveral or somewhere, like, you know, in Florida. And this, our protagonist here, who I wanted Kate to play, hopped into a car with a diaper on and drove from Houston to Florida faster than the airplane did. All right, and she gets to the airport and she waits around until that other female astronaut comes out, and she's got a crowbar and like a knife and stuff, and she follows her to her car and she tries to kill her. All right, and then the other female astronaut escaped. She wasn't killed. She called the cops, and this main character basically went to jail on trial, and then eventually to jail. And I wanted to do a whole movie with Kate that basically it took place entirely in the car ride. It was cutting between the car ride, which had all sorts of flashbacks in it, and then flash forward to the court case, which had all sorts of other like elucidating things. And you'd see this woman in the car who's completely feverish, psychologically damaged, and just a kind of like in the throes of this disturbing emotional imbalance. And then in the court, you'd see the person who became an astronaut, who, you know, was part of NASA, who went to like West Point, and who was completely like sane and rational, and you know, one of America's best. So we talked about maybe one day we would write that, or I would get into that soon. It was a conversation we had. Then Kate came back a few days later. And not a few days later, but maybe like a month later. And she said, "How's it going?" And I said, "Bad. Like, I haven't started that movie. I'm trying to write this other movie, and it's not going well. And I'm having trouble writing all these scripts." And she said, "Well, why don't you make an improv movie?" And I said, "No, I don't know. Improv movie, that sounds so boring. I've seen a lot of people try to do that recently, and it's bad, and I don't like it, and I avoid those movies. And I'm sorry if you're in all of them, Kate, but I don't like them." And then she said, "No, come on, you can make a good one. We can make a good one together." And I said, "All right, maybe. That could be something. Who knows?" So she planted the idea in my head. And then Christian, as usual, once every few months, he'd hit me up, be like, "Yo, what's up? How you doing? Are we going to make this movie? Are we going to make that movie?" I said, "I got a movie for you, Christian." And then I realized, like, I could make an improv movie with Kate. And I went to Christian and I said, "I got my friend. She's a very good actress. She's on House of Cards. She's a reputable actress. She gets into film festivals. And have this scene where there's a couple arguing in the 4th of July. And, you know, they're arguing, they're screaming. And all of a sudden, fireworks start going off. Pew, pew. And then the camera flies away from them, surveys all the fireworks, and when it comes back to the couple that was arguing, now they're fucking, all right? And then he loved that. He loved that concept of that scene. And just with that scene, this is how much he moved me. He wrote me a check. Not for a lot, but for enough to get started, to get the movie off the ground. And this was in beginning of June, and Kate had told me that we could make an improv movie at the end of June, because she's going to be in LA for 10 days before she has to fly to Tokyo on like a big Hollywood job. And I was like, "Okay, great." And so I took the check and I'm like, "Holy shit, like who's the couple? What is the movie about? Kate's in it, I know that." And I was like, "Why isn't it, who would be in a fight? Maybe some exes. Maybe, like, I should be in it because I'm not going to have time to write the script. And I know how, like, Kate and I have a dynamic, so why don't we explore that dynamic? And what's our dynamic? We're exes who stayed friends." All right. So now Kate comes to visit, right? Is that the idea? And then it just sort of wrote itself from there. Like, these two exes who are friends have this weekend together where they, like, you know, for under the guise of doing a business deal, because they used to run a business together, have this sort of trying emotional experience that is parts hilarious, other parts depressing, other parts just like emotionally naked. And I told Kate, "Hey, I got some money, we're gonna do this, you know?" And she said, "What's it about?" And I told her what I just said into the camera, and she said, "I'm in." And then it's like, you get a team. And then the real anxiety begins. Once you have the check and the star, you're like, "Oh no, like, who's gonna help me do this?" And so I knew that Joan, my girlfriend, who basically helped me make it from beginning to end, one, you know, is very good with props and sets and stuff. So she said, "You're gonna be a production designer." A few weeks earlier, we were talking about just random movie titles that we thought would be good, and we came up with A Wonderful Cloud, because it was just basically at the same time extremely vague and extremely like endlessly vague and endlessly moronic, you know. So we went with that, and that was the movie. And then after I deposited the check, literally like an hour later, Joan and I went to a party, and I saw Brandy, who is someone that I had worked with many times before on music videos. And I said to her, and we hadn't worked for a while together. And I said, want to make a feature film? And she's like, what? And I'm like, in a month, we're going to make a whole movie. Like a month from now, for a week, we're going to make a whole movie. Are you in? And she said, sure. She like nodded. I don't know if she regrets that now. Maybe she does. Certainly put a strain on our friendship or what was left of it at that point. But she was down. And basically, a week or two earlier, I'd been at a wedding and I was hanging out with my good friend Lisa and her boyfriend at the time, Dan. And I said to Dan, I knew he was a DP, I said, Dan, we got to work on something together, you know? And after I reached out to Brandy, I reached out to Dan. And I said, Dan, like, I think I might have something for us to work on. It's a movie. Like, how do you feel about that? He's like, I've never shot a movie. I've only shot, like, music videos and skate videos and documentary stuff. I said, well, let's do it. Like, there's a first time. Like, let's do it. And he consulted he's like, let me think about it. And he consulted the I Ching the next morning. And he said the signs point that I should take this, that it said I should take on challenges now. Everything is in our favor if I take on challenges. And I said, well, this is going to be fucking challenging because we got no money and we want it to look good. And you know, and that takes equipment, that takes a team, grip, electric, assistant camera, all that stuff, not to mention props, styling. So when Dan was on, then Lisa, you know, I asked Lisa, who's a great stylist, Lisa TV, Lisa Katnick, and she said, yeah, she'd do it too. And this is all people who are doing it basically for free. Brandy and Lisa and Dan and Joan and me and Kate, all doing it for free, which is insane, which is a crazy labor of love. Like, it's a crazy feeling of love and respect you have for people when they do that. And it's an intense responsibility you put on yourself when you know that's going down, because you have to make sure you're being very respectful and working very hard, and that people are have a fair voice in what's going on, you know. And at the same time, you have to make sure you stay true to what your vision of the original thing is, because film is a very collaborative process. It should be. Hopefully the people you work with are cool, intelligent, and get what you're trying to do, and then they'll bring so much great stuff to the table, which is what happened here. But at the same time, like, you got to make sure that if something is like interrupting or obtruding your vision, don't let it intrude. Don't let it dissolve the purity of the thing you're trying to do. Only let things amplify the purity of what you're trying to do, if that makes sense. So we got the whole team together, and then Dan was a kind of miracle worker, and he brought on all these people, all these guys that owed him favors, and that love working with him, and that he enjoys getting paid work for, said, hey, will you guys work for nothing for this movie, for me? And so many of them did, and Laban, and Lambert, and Chris Bredson, and Chris Slater, and all these guys came on, and my boy Jake, who's my sound guy for so many projects, he came on, and we had a team. And then Dan and Brandy and I sat at Brandy's apartment for about a week and a half and wrote out the whole outline. I wrote a lot of it in one night, and then we all revised it together, and we made shot lists and schedules. So basically, I wrote a big chunk of it. And then based on that, we made shot lists and schedules. Dan doing the shot list, Brandy doing the schedule, me going in between both of them. Ooh, the tape's still on? Hope that's not been playing. So then you're like, okay, well, we just wrote all these roles and I had some people in mind, but now I need to cast, you know? So at the same time, I'm like, while we're doing some casting, and there's a lot of speaking parts we decide. It's not just me and Kate in a room, even though some parts it is. There's all these great people, and I'm lucky that I was able to wrangle and convince a lot of people who should get a lot of airtime, but don't, because the conventional movie making system does not have room for them, or is not working to discover them, or they're just not a part of it because they don't care, because they didn't show up here to audition 20 times a week. They showed up here to, like, live an interesting life, and they are interesting, and they're great performers. And so you have people like Lauren Avery, and you have people, or they're born here, or you have people like Elisha Drones, Rachel Lord, Zach Shipko, and then luckily we found a really great actor, John Ennis, to play a fashion guy, fashion icon, and a fashion designer, and it did. It just all came together. It was a difficult shoot in some ways, because can you imagine putting a feature length film into 8.5 days of shooting? And in other ways, it's very simple but very easy, because it was over very quickly. Even though there was a serious amount, I would say there was some collateral damage from the shoot. Emotionally, people were very distraught, I think, afterwards. That's another thing that weighs heavily on your mind as a director when you're working in a low budget environment, is it's straining for people to give of themselves, and even if they believe in the project, feel like it's in good hands. Even if they trust you, even if they believe in the project, it hurts, because they've put in so much. So after those 8.5 days, which to me went by in a flash, but that's probably because I was in a lot of the movie and running around and sleeping like 1 hour a night or whatever. And I don't know if any filmmakers are watching, you'll understand this. If not, this might be interesting. Like, when you're in a crazy shoot like that, where you are using your locations, like my house that I just moved out of, or, you know, like you're in it and you're directing it and you wrote it or something like that, or and you're working like 18-hour days or 19-hour days. When you sleep, you're like, most of your nightmares will be like, oh my God, I'm in the movie, like the movie's happening right now, but I'm here asleep. Like, it's happening around me. And it's like people are shooting and you're just there paralyzed. Like, that's the number one nightmare I always get on like a shoot that goes longer than like 3 days. It's always like, I'm on set. It's especially scary when your house is part of the set. And you're just laying there paralyzed, like, why am I ruining this? Like, everyone's waiting for me. Or, like, they're shooting around me, but I'm ruining all the shots because my limpid sleeping body is in it, you know? So that was, like, part of the nightmare. And whatever, logistically, just hard to make a movie. But, like, so many people came through. Brandy got us so many good locations. We were able to shoot at Kaechung, which that scene came out to be quite emotional. Kate made herself available at all times. All the other actors came through, and it was just this great labor of love. And you know, and then you get into the editing, and I had this editor that I work with a lot named Ben Moses Smith, and he too came to the table basically expecting nothing, just wanted to make this movie, which was a labor of love, which is a personal project, and put himself into it, you know. And like a few other people, he had just had a serious romantic trauma. He broke up with someone that he had been with for several years, and he had just come off of it. And I said, use that, like channel that into the edit, you know. And maybe that sounds like bullshit, and maybe it was almost disrespectful of his feelings, but I have this belief for real that cinema especially is so palpable, it's so receptive to like the emotional states of being, and the energy that people, I don't want to get whatever hippy dippy, but the emotional states of being that people are putting out there, that the camera will receive it. And then when you're in the editing room, the rhythm of the cuts or what you select as the footage will receive it. So when we worked together, Ben was very focused and very like sensitive, I think, to the material. And it showed in the movie. And that process was fun. And of course, I guess what I really want to talk about is how all this stuff causes anxiety, but I'm really just giving sort of like a timeline of what happened, which is fine too. But I don't know, it's just like, yeah. So then I'm working with Ben every day, and we're working in his apartment, which is kind of like, when he's not hired for a big job, it's kind of like his home studio, right? So I'm there, and we had worked together on a web series before called Feast of Burden. And that, when we did that, we had two editors, Ben and this guy Parker. When I worked with Ben and Parker, I worked at their house for like 17 hours. I took over their lives, which is a shitty thing to do, especially since they're being paid zero to very little. And we would, you know, sit there like for a long time, have, you know, lunch and dinner, and go late into the night, and I'd leave at like 1 a.m. back then. So Ben laid down some rules that, like, this would be max 12 hours. You could come at 9, and you will leave at 9, the latest. But usually I think it went more like 10 to 7 or something, which is fine. You know, if you're not getting paid 9 hours with lunch in there, it's pretty good. And with that, and because I think we shot the movie in 8 days, you know, and we were only able to do, like, 3, tops 5 takes, usually 2 to 3 takes per shot. And some scenes were like long takes, one shot, you know, very little coverage. We were able to edit the movie basically into a rough cut in about, we had an assembly in a month, then we had a rough cut in another month, and then by, I believe, September, we had a director's cut. You know, we finished shooting like July 5th, so then July, August, September, we had a director's cut. October, we basically had the final cut. We submitted that. We got into South by Southwest, which was great. It's like, you know, basically the number 2 festival in America after Sundance. And then we had to finish it. And that sometimes takes way longer than picture locking it. You know, so we had to do like nice sound mix and get the song secured and do some color correction. All that stuff took time. And ultimately, I had to ask Christian for more money for that. I think Christian ended up giving double the amount he intended. I hope he'll see some money back. I hope all the people who worked for free will get some money back, if that's somehow possible. But yeah, I mean, so now South by Southwest was very anxiety inducing because the goal of a festival like that is to get maximum exposure for your film. That is maximum press, and hopefully have a distribution company buy it. So the first step to that is having a sales representative. And so we sent the movie out, and you know, when they find out who's on the list, who made it, who got selected, a lot of these sales companies contact you, sales agencies. I got contacted by very few. The ones that I did send it to, those and a few others, all passed on it. So then we're going to the festival being like, okay, well, no one wants to sell. That's already kind of a bad sign. Because those motherfuckers' jobs is to get the acquisitions people from distributors in the house to see it. You know, because the big festival, there's like 100 movies playing that you're competing against. None of them have distribution, more or less. And you got to make sure that the people who matter, you know, obviously the film fans matter, but a big festival like that, journalists matter, and the distribution acquisitions people matter, you know, like Weinstein Company, IFC Films, Magnolia, like these are kind of like independent tier distribution companies. And I don't know if we had any of those, I just don't know. But what we did have, so I was lucky that my friend's mom is a very cool lawyer, and she's an entertainment lawyer, and she was there at the fest naturally, and I said, please come check out my movie. Her name is Linda Lichter. You can look her up. She's done a lot of big deals. She like sold Reservoir Dogs and Sex Lies and Videotape and made those deals big deals, and basically ushered in an era where American independent filmmaking was an avenue for maverick voices to make movies that were seen in the mainstream that could actually make money in a theater. It was a weird transitional era, I guess, that basically ended by the end of the 90s, you know, like around the time of like Boogie Nights or something like that, Out of Sight, basically with the death of New Line Cinemas and then Focus Features, sort of like turned into this, didn't, you know, there was a void. And that void still exists, actually. That void has existed for the last 15 years. There's no fundamental framework. Any film person will know this, but if you're not a film person, there's no fundamental framework for like independent voice to get a good chunk of money to make a movie that could be commercial. I mean, you can do it. You can scramble and hustle just like you had to in the 80s. Or in the late 70s when kind of the bottom fell out from the new Hollywood, you know, You just scramble and try to make it happen, and you know, make sure you have producers that can figure these things out for you. But there isn't this influx of money how there was in the 90s. One of the reasons that happened, backtracking, one of the reasons that happened is because of Linda and the deals that she brokered with companies like Weinstein, like Miramax, and etc. Okay, and Fine Wine and New Wine and all that stuff. All right. So Linda came to this first screening, and she saw it, and she loved it, and that was very cool because she's not only a lawyer, but she's also a sales rep. So she joined the movie. She joined our team. Obviously very humble. Our movie is very humble compared to all the other films that we're playing there, just in terms of budget and in terms of kind of like, well, it's very like, the movie itself is very open and is very, like, confessional and diaristic. You know, it's like a rap mixtape. Like, you know, Universal Music or RCA or whatever, Capitol Records, not going to release a rap mixtape, even though it might be better than the album that that rapper is making. Because of maybe its quality, or because maybe it's too raw, or because maybe it doesn't follow certain commercial parameters. So it's a challenge. But in for a filmmaker, if you make something that's raw and authentic and feels like from the gut, you know it's going to connect with audiences. And my goal is to be doing this for life, right? So I have to find a way to put that out there and make it available, but also make sure that Christian, who gave me money, gets his money back. Or all the people who worked on it for free can see something besides their hard work. Even though I think they'll be happy with that, they should be compensated somehow. Or maybe I could pay for groceries once from the movie. That would be nice. So anyway, that's why you want to sell it, as opposed to like a rapper uploading a mixtape. And you know, like obviously the goal of that is to get signed, blah blah. It's maybe a false analog, but I think you understand what I'm saying. Anyway, so through Linda, we were actually able to get distribution through a company that was very enthusiastic named Film Buff. And that's what has happened the last few months. So now Film Buff, and we've got 9 minutes left, so I might as well bring it to close. So Film Buff is now putting out the movie. It's coming out in LA, the Pasadena Playhouse Lemley, on October 23rd, which is a few days from now, Friday. It's going to be playing 5 times a day from Friday to the next Thursday, which is October 29th. And I'm fucking excited. And it's on iTunes. It's on your internet VOD, which is like what? Like Voodoo, Amazon, Hulu, Google Play, all that stuff, Vimeo. And it's on your like cable on demand. So if you have like Time Warner Cable, Comcast, Cox, Cablevision, should be able to search your video on demand. And watch it, which would be great, because now you know how we made it. And but the challenge, of course, also is like, okay, basically zero people are watching this right now because I didn't really tell anyone, and maybe down the line like 100 people will watch this, literally like this thing, confession, potentially less. And how do you get people to see a good movie? Like, I am confident, I don't think my movie's earth-shattering, but I know it has qualities that are valuable in a film. It's entertaining, okay, it's funny, it's emotional, so I think it's entertaining. It's not boring, it goes by very quickly, and it does something different, right? It does something new. It presents this type of relationship dynamic in a new way. It uses the, like, fibrous, palpable emotions that are really there between Kate and myself to sort of mine through this like emotional territory. And I know that's quite different than what you usually see in these sorts of films. And it's presented in this sort of like off the cuff style that I think really suits the diaristic quality of the film. So I know it's good, and I'm gonna bet my buckaroo butt that it's better than most American improvised film from the last whatever 15 years. that attempt to do things like this that were sort of like grievously called mumblecore or whatever, and potentially this will be grouped into that, even though I think the moment for that sort of assignation is over. Like nothing is really assigned to that anymore because we're in a presumably post-mumblecore time. But because of the, you know, nature of the movie, improvised, white people, whatever, this is going to be mumblecore. But I'd say from a bottom dollar, it is much more entertaining because the goal for me always when I'm making something is to engage people. It's not to be self-indulgent. It's to challenge people, engage them, and have fun. That's what I like at the movie. I want to have a boisterous time. I want to watch something lively and entertaining, and I think our movie does that. But then the challenge is, how do you let people know that it's worth their time and worth their money? Like, movies aren't as inherently as demanding or as predominant in the cultural conversation as they once were. That's not a surprise. I'm not saying something that people don't know, whether consciously, I mean, if you're like a movie person, movie maker, or in the movie industry, you know that. People aren't getting around the water cooler talking about any old movie, whereas they might be getting around the water cooler and talking about like any old TV show. You know, you don't even really have to be a TV show of note for people to discuss you as being culturally relevant. But to be a movie that's discussed as culturally relevant, you do have to break through a certain barrier. And for a very small film where literally the marketing of one billboard for like Transformers or Avengers or whatever costs more money, you know, like renting one billboard and putting it up and, you know, printing it out and putting it up costs more money than our entire budget for our movie. You know, that's very challenging. And the distributor is putting a lot behind it, but it's certainly not enough to penetrate a certain normal crowd. So then you sort of, we're going to hit like a specialty demographic or something. But it's like those people who have discerning taste are very skeptical about watching stuff that targets them, I think. You know, they want to find it themselves. They don't want someone to like crowd in on them. There's nothing lamer than going on Pitchfork and seeing, you know, this is like an example that might have been relevant like 2 years ago, but going on Pitchfork and seeing an ad for an album on the Pitchfork website that wasn't really reviewed by the website. So clearly it's like irrelevant, but like that's the audience they want to target, but like Pitchfork doesn't even review it. Or if they did review it, it's like buried and it's a bad review, you know? So a discerning crowd who is adventurous doesn't want to be told what to watch. And if they do come upon something good, there's a high probability that they might just want to pirate it, you know? So it's a very tough time for a filmmaker. And then the barrier to entry for this type of movie is the cost, right? So I think we have like iTunes first week is going to be 99-cent rentals. So, you know, keep an eye out for that. And that's, I think, reasonable. Like you know, I think anything up until like $2.99 for a rental is reasonable, you know? But then once you get higher than that, you know, they have all these internal pricing systems that I'm not privy to. So then you think, we don't have a lot of money for marketing, but maybe like some PR or some stunt marketing or something. So lately I've been doing this stunt marketing, which I've been writing these fake articles, okay, that have talked about the movie as if it was a big deal, right? So the first one said that it was a remake. It was purchased by a fake Hollywood company to be remade, starring Meryl Streep in Kate's role and Dustin Hoffman in my role, and then moved to a nursing home where they had an investigation. And in the movie, they're also exes, remained friends, and they live in the nursing home together. And, you know, and it's just preposterous. But the way the article was written was very, like, legitimate, and so everybody ate it up. They thought it was real. They thought it was really happening. Everyone's so excited for me, which is a little bit tricky, right? Because on social media, people do want to live out the successes of their friends vicariously, right? Like, if you're succeeding, it's almost like they're succeeding. Or at least it makes them feel good for you. That's a natural human instinct, and it's extended in this weird way through the, you know, jumble of acquaintances that have become friends, you know, or followers or whatever in our virtual world. And So I think it's funny. Ultimately, I think when some people found out that it was fake, they weren't upset. They weren't butthurt. They were happy for me. They thought it was funny, and they thought it was a good ruse. You know, they were in on it with me. Then recently, I read another one that said the movie was banned in New York because we weren't able to all sorts of complications in terms of the window that we had, because we wanted to release it in LA, then New York. There's no theater that had that window open, and then to do it like a month later would be a little bit weird because our momentum would be over and we'd already be out on cable and no you know, VOD and iTunes, and no theater would want to show it if all that stuff was out. So it's kind of impossible to get a run in New York. So then I wrote this article that said we were banned in New York, and I made up all these things like the censorship board and the NYPD deputy of cultural affairs. All these things don't exist. And they commented on the movie and how, how disgusting, smutty, and dirty it was, and how it didn't deserve to be seen by the good people of New York, and got to keep it off our streets. So that happened, and people believe that too. And I have more coming, and since nobody's watching this, I can tell you there's going to be one that where Kate reveals that I conned her into doing the movie, blackmailed her, which I think should be juicy tidbit for TMZ or something like that. And then they were going to do a fourth one after the opening weekend for like a box office website, maybe like Box Office Mojo, where I talk about how much money the movie made, that it broke all these records, all right? That should really get people on board. So that's basically it. That's where I'm at. We have a really good PR team in the movie. They're the same people who did it for South by Southwest. They're called Brigade. They've reached out to everybody. I wish I was doing more interviews, honestly, but I think, the lead-in time, because I wanted to hit it before award season, which is November, which a lot of movies are out for people to see. I wanted to hit it before Halloween, which is the end of the month. So basically now is the time. So we had to put it out now, and I like it, but didn't give them a lot of lead-up time. But I think, people will, I hope. You have to hope as a filmmaker that people will find it. And part of your anxiety is that you let down all the people that believed in you, like the investor, and like all the people who worked for free, who collaborated with you, like the actors who all worked for free and bared their souls. You know, you asked them to be some naked version of themselves, dressed up in different clothing. And you just hope that the movie makes a sort of impact on the world where everyone feels like their contribution and the sacrifice, you know, that they made is recognized or is validated by connecting with an audience. And that's all you can ask for. And so that's all I'm kind of praying for. And that's what keeps me up at night. That's what makes me anxious when I talk to the PR people. That's what makes me anxious when I talk to the distributor. That's what makes me anxious when I go back to the actors and tell them to like promo the film, you know, even though some of them haven't seen it, and the crew too, and they're gonna see it for the first time on Friday, and I hope they like it, you know? I don't know, I guess I'm just hoping for the best. I'm really nervous. Last time I had a movie that came out, when I was 24 years old or 25 years old, I almost went to every screening. I played for a week in New York. I'm probably not going to do that here, but I will be at the screenings on Friday and Saturday. I hope they go well. I hope people turn out. And I hope this wasn't too boring, listening to how it all came together, listening to the trials and tribulations, listening to, you know, there's a lot more that I didn't get into. Probably could have gone for 2 hours. Probably should have compressed it to 30 minutes. But there's, you know, a lot more that a lot more like anxiety, a lot more dark feelings that came of it. But hopefully the movie has a lot of good feelings and a lot of stuff for people to explore and connect with. All right, I'm headed out. Eric Felix is here for Strip Mall. Thank you for listening to this very confessional episode of Open Up and Bleed. Probably 2 weeks from now, I'm not going to be here next week, but 2 weeks from now, we'll have another show with a guest that will be potentially way more dynamic. But thanks for tuning in. This has been K-Chung Radio, 1630 AM. KitchenRadio.org online. You can go through the archive, open up and bleed, and you can listen to this, which will be, I think, episode 19. And thanks for hearing me out. Woo! Done, Eric.